Rob Wolf, Andy Dees back with episode 39, Paleolithic Solution. We are almost to the big 4-0.
Dude, we have more podcasts now than I am old, which is good. That's good.
Does that make you feel younger, Rob?
It would if I wasn't still beat up from the Move Nat thing and then jiu-jitsu last night. Bruno Lima is going to be gone for a month, and so he absolutely beat the tar out of me last night. So I'm feeling about 85, like 85 chain smoker, hard drinking 85 today. So, yeah.
Well, you know, this way you can recover for the full month and maybe we'll be ready to go by the time Bruno gets back.
Yeah, and what little work capacity I built will be completely gone.
Awesome. So I know on your blog you wrote a series of posts from the jungle or the mountains of West Virginia, whichever it may be. So tell us a little bit about the MoveNat seminar you went to.
You know, it was phenomenal. I knew, like, Erwan and I have talked a bunch over the last couple of months via email, on Skype, on the phone, and he's just a very, very bright guy, very passionate about what he's doing. And obviously has some pretty amazing physical capacity. And so I knew I was going to learn some stuff going into this, but I honestly, like, I was shocked by how good of an eye for movement, prehab, rehab that Erwan has. I was also really surprised by some of the immediate improvements in my own performance, just largely related to, like, some proprioceptive issues in my ankles from numerous kind of ankle rolls from, like, snowboarding and kickboxing and different stuff like that. And it really helped a bunch. Like, I was shocked. And despite the bug bites and the scratches and we got chased and stung by hornets on one day when we were trying to work our way down to the lake that was about 2.5 miles away. Despite all that stuff, which was fairly uncomfortable, you know, I miss it this week. Like, it was a whole lot of learning. It's really nice receiving coaching. Like, I just provide a lot of coaching, and it's really rare that I get feedback on my own movement. Have somebody that I can ask questions that has some insight into what I have going on with my own game. Like, I was asking him about different ways to modify the MoveNat principles to improve my jiu-jitsu game and stuff like that. And it was really, really fun. It was really refreshing. And I'm, you know, I knew I was going to like it, but honestly, I'm surprised how much I did, in fact, like it. And definitely looking at going to the probably the January Thailand gig if everything falls into place. So it was a good time, really good time, really good coaching. Definitely have some new tricks to put into my tool bag. But even beyond that, like, had some kind of perceptual changes in how to tackle training. So it was cool.
Rob,
hey,
holy shnikes, dude. Okay. There was some craziness. Rob, we're back. We'll edit it out. We're fine. It was live. Your MoveNat thing was good. So you were saying you're thinking about going to the Thailand one.
Yeah, yeah. Thinking about going to the Thailand one if everything falls into place. Probably January module on that. And there's a potential of doing some stuff in Australia and New Zealand as well. And would probably dovetail that into some Paleolithic Solution seminars also. So good stuff. Like, very excited about tinkering with all the MoveNat stuff further and integrating it into the game plan.
Uh-oh. And did you do your barefoot run through the hills?
Yeah. Like, the final day was, it was pretty insane. Like, barefoot running through the just West Virginia forest, which, I mean, it sticks and twigs and thorns, and we dove through a mud bog, and it was fairly crazy. But that was one of the things, like, I'm shocked that I was able to do it. Like, there was definitely a lot of discomfort with it, but at the end of it, it was one of those things where you're like, wow, that was pretty impressive. I'm surprised that I was able to nut up and get all that done. So it was actually pretty cool.
Very cool. And Rob, since this is the first episode post CrossFit Games that we're recording, and you're recording from your office with the echo, like like we're in Real Genius and Kent is being talked to from God via the microphone and a receiver in his teeth. Give us your thoughts on the CrossFit Games, Rob Wolf.
You know, I didn't get, obviously, I totally struck out on my predictions of handstand walking and bicycles, so I totally struck out on that. I only caught a little bit, like I caught the huge Helen workout where they did a full Helen, two-thirds of a Helen, and then one round of Helen. I saw that one, and then I saw one chunk of the final where people were like falling off the rope and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's pretty impressive. I mean, the infrastructure that they put into place with regards to the media and all that is remarkable. That was pretty cool. You know, the athletic performance is obviously totally remarkable. Huge output going on, but I just didn't get a chance to tune in for a ton of it. But it'll be interesting to see how all that stuff develops. You know, like the strongman, I think, is compelling in that you've got some like freakishly big dudes, and you have some very easy to understand events. You know, like you flip over some small cars, you pick up a refrigerator and run with it, and stuff like that. And most of the events are pretty short. You know, I think typically under a minute. You know, maybe 2 minutes max, something like that. But they're typically on the short end. They're heavy. It's impressive. And I think for so many people, a lot of the CrossFit stuff, like seeing somebody run, do a ton of kipping pull-ups and swing kettlebells, I mean, it is abject misery. Like, until you do that stuff, you don't understand just how hard it is. But I'm curious how much of a draw it will be to folks that are not doing this type of training. And granted, like the number of people doing this type of training is growing every day, and so it may be just fine simply serving that kind of niche market, which eventually becomes not really a niche. It may become quite large, but some elements of it are kind of like, okay, I'm checking it out. I could come back like 5 minutes later and people are still running, they're still doing pull-ups, they're still swinging kettlebells, and so it'll be interesting to see how they tweak and modify that stuff to play to a visual media market. You know, like football has modified a lot of how it operates to play itself to like advertising and short attention span and all that sort of stuff. MMA modified its approach, so like if there's a too much time spent on the ground and people not really trying to advance what they're up, you know, what they're doing, then they stand them back up. So it'll be interesting to see how that the sport of fitness develops over time.
Yep.
You checked out a little bit of it.
Oh, I watched every minute, Rob.
You did? Okay.
Pretty much. I'm a sucker for punishment. I mean, one, I thought it was fascinating that it was all available in HD for free online. Like, that was pretty cool. It struck me, just totally unrelated to the event, you know, how challenging it is for people to actually commentate sports. And, you know, nothing against any of the commentators, but obviously these aren't professional commentators that do this every day. And so, you know, watching them commentate like the affiliate cup fireman's carries across the field was just one of the funniest things I've ever watched. Because there's only so many things you could say about carrying someone across the field running. And it was just very humorous to watch. But, you know, I thought it was entertaining. Obviously amazing athletes. I still struggle with the idea of, you know, what competition should look like versus training, and that clearly was competition, and I'm not sure everyone else's training should look exactly like that. So I have all these kind of thoughts always rolling in my head around that. But, you know, amazing athletes, amazing work output, some stunning form flaws repeated thousands of times over, which I question the long-term intelligence of that. But it was a cool event, and it's amazing just to see how much it's grown just from, you know, the ranch to, you know, all the commentators wearing Under Armour shirts and Progenics logos. And I did really enjoy, like, a couple of the events, like the sandbag event where they had to climb up into the stands and pull down the sandbags and run them across the floor of the stadium and then up into the other side. And I did enjoy, you know, even though I thought the final event kind of with the three little wads might have been excessive in length, like I appreciated them adding some new challenges with, you know, climbing over the wall and then the rope climb paired with the burpees where you had to kind of jump over that 6-foot military wall. Like, I thought those were were cool events that clearly folks hadn't specifically trained for. And so I thought that added a new dynamic, different than, you know, the one like the deadlift, you know, pistol, double under wad, which is kind of standard in CrossFit, even though you don't see that many pistols. But I know, you know, a fair amount of people spend time working on those. So I think it's just interesting to see some of the transfer, if there is any, you know, because I feel like some of those events that people aren't training for are certainly favoring, you know, raw athleticism in some cases. You know, it's not really going to matter in some ways how they've trained.
What the skill set is, yeah, totally. Well, I can definitely say after the MoveNat weekend, like, there are huge variables in efficiency and technique getting on, over, and around objects. And there's a whole world waiting for a lot of people to learn how to streamline that type of stuff. It's having watched that and then done that weekend at the expansion course, it'll be interesting to see who starts broadening out their skill set and who they go to for coaching to figure their games out, because there are some things that could be dropped in. Like we saw this, and you mentioned it, you know, like the guy was heading into the finals doing really well and then didn't really have rope climbs.
Yep.
and was done. I think Miko had some problems with some double unders and he was done. You know, there are some macro climbing odd object lifting, surmounting, getting on or around them and stuff like that, that now I could easily program into an event that would shut down 80% of people. But then the people who have the skill set, they'd be fine. And I mean, it makes the technicality of simply doing a ring muscle up, which if you're pretty athletic, you can kind of figure out how to do it. It makes that technicality look kind of infantile. So there's a wide world of stuff waiting to be unleashed on people, and it's very, very interesting. It'll be cool to see where it goes.
Yeah, and I think that's where I always enjoy like watching. I don't know if you've ever seen, Rob, the Ninja Warrior series on G4. But you know, similar in that, you know, some of the events they're climbing and stuff, you know, their work output probably isn't as high, but some of the demands of figuring out the courses that they're having to climb under duress is totally different than, you know, 15 muscle-ups in a row. Obviously, 15 muscle-ups in a row is impressive, but it's just a different thing, you know, climbing on apparatuses or trees or rocks as opposed to, you know, some standard apparatus that you've done 1,000 times over practicing.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, usually if you look at, I think in Japan they call it Sasuke, and then Ninja Warrior here, most of those events have a cap in the time, and they tend to be about a minute and a half to 3 minutes, which is just about where, even though people aren't doing a ton, you know, like you said, say like 15 muscle-ups in a row, they are doing enough work output that they're going to be real heavy into that lactate red line. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that they are doing is of a technical enough nature that you really need to know what you're doing to be able to pull it off. I mean, it ends up shutting down like world champion gymnasts and a lot of different folks. If they're not getting a little bit of specificity in those movements, people end up failing. It's pretty interesting.
Yep. All right, Rob, we're 15 minutes in. We're making progress. On to the questions.
We've done nothing substantive or of quality yet. So
we added value to the CrossFit Games commentary. And you shared some thoughts on the MoveNat seminar, and I feel like that's a win. I mean, that's good content, Rob.
I'm sure HQ will be very pleased by that.
All right, Rob, first question from Nick. He says, I'm about a month into changing to paleo diet and seeing good results so far. I've been slowly working my way through your older podcasts, and I heard you mention that you're opposed to liquid drinks due to the spike in insulin associated with them. I was wondering if you could expand on that specifically in regard to green smoothies. I've been preparing these myself as a way to get in more veggies with a meal, as well as spiking them with fish oil, since taking shots of oil doesn't work for me. Even in small quantities, I gag it back up. A typical smoothie recipe for me would be 10 ounces of some form of frozen berries, 16 ounces of veggies, one avocado for smoother texture, a tablespoon of cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon vanilla bean, and water to thin it out if it's too thick. Typically, I'll drink a glass of this with my meal and add a tablespoon of Carlson's fish oil, since that's pretty much the only way I've figured out how to get it down. Does liquefying the food in a blender end up making it more insulin spiking, or was that said more in regards to juicing? Thanks.
Really good question, really interesting question. Any time that we process food at all, it increases the glycemic load. Speeds up how quickly we're going to absorb those nutrients. So even if we take just like a piece of steak and we eat that steak, the speed with which those proteins enter our system, the amino acids enter our system, is going to be at one rate. If we grind that steak into hamburger, it's going to enter our system faster. If we take that whole thing, and I think somebody mentioned a couple of podcasts back, like some sort of like beef protein powder, where they actually like turn, you know, essentially like steak into protein powder, that hits our system even more quickly. So it's the difference between like a log and kindling and a handful of sawdust. Like the more that you process it, the quicker the stuff burns, essentially. So, you know, the concern that I have with this is the glycemic load and how quickly this stuff ends up hitting the system. If you are lean, you don't have any signs and symptoms of hyperinsulinism, you don't have any blood sugar crashes after doing something like this, then I guess go for it. I mean, the composition that's going in here looks pretty darn good. A cucumber smoothie seems odd to me in some ways, but you know, it when I'm looking at the cinnamon and the berries, it probably tastes okay and all that. So all that stuff said, the absolutely processing your food increases the insulin load, the glycemic load. There's no doubt about that. As to whether or not that's a horrible thing for you to do, that's very dependent on what your situation is. It's not something I personally would do all that much, but you know, you could certainly play with it and see how it goes.
Yeah, I don't know if I could get this down.
I would give it a shot. I mean, I've drank enough odd stuff. I would probably give it a shot. Yeah.
But I mean, I do understand Nick's issue with regards to, especially if you're not one that likes to eat a lot of veggies, this is a way to actually, you know, to get a fair amount down quicker.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you pointed out, it's very different than eating the food. It'd be hard to eat that many veggies in a reasonable amount of time.
Right. Or you could just go the Kurt Harris route, which is, you know, grass-fed meat, pastured dairy, you know, all butter and, you know, get your vegetables in the form of meat. So,
it's my preferred approach.
Seriously.
Confirmation bias all around. All right. Next, we had a question from Dan. Excited about this question. Rob, I've listened to your recent recommendations regarding NAS superenzymes and how to determine dosing. I've recently started taking them, increasing one tablet each meal. I've gotten to seven tablets with no warm or fuzzy feeling. According to Poliquin, if you get to seven with no warm feeling, stop the test, you are acloridic. I have searched far and wide, however, and can find no recommendation as to what I should do now. Is Poliquin right? And if so, what do I do from here, i.e., what is the treatment for acloridia?
You can tackle this a couple of different ways. One, you try to find a doc who specializes in acloridia, and typically what they are going to do, they're going to do a thorough investigation with regards to your digestive health, like an ONP, an ova and parasite. They're going to probably do some scoping to make sure that you don't have any type of a parasitic or like bacterial infection or something like that, because those situations can impact your digestion. And then short of that, like my opinion is that still using something like the Now Food super enzymes to support your digestion as best you can, but probably keeping the dosage at about like 4 to 5 capsules. And then you need to be really fastidious about your sleep, about training, about chewing your food very, very well, about not overeating. So those are the things that you would do. You're basically going to tackle this as you do everything that you possibly can to make your digestion better. And you know, we were just talking about like smoothies and stuff like that. So maybe this is a situation where you do make some vegetable smoothies, you know, like if you're going to get some veggies or you do a soup, you do puree it, but you still need to chew it. You need to chew that pureed food, or that at least somewhat processed food. Say, like if you make soups and stews, you need to chew it as if it was solid food. And this can be somewhat mind-numbingly boring for people, but it will work. And over time, you should be able to reestablish some digestive fire. Cutting out things like iced water, not drinking liquids with meals, those things will definitely help your digestion also. But there are some docs you need to poke around to find them that may help with achloridia. But the, you know, on the kind of practical implementation side, it really boils down to make the foods that you're digesting, consume them in a way that maximally supports the whole operation. Don't overeat. Make sure you have some nice, relaxed environment. Chew the food really well, all that sort of stuff. No cold beverages with it. Really not much extra fluid at all, because all that tends to dilute digestive enzymes, stuff times.
Yep. All right, good. Good question. Next, got a question.
Yeah. And Dan, if Dan here with that, and it would definitely be cool to hear back an improvement in the signs and symptoms and all that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Next, got a question from Gary. Rob, do you have any information on the validity of the ELISA method of food allergy testing? I recently had a food allergy panel done. In addition to telling me that I should avoid eggs, it also says I should avoid beef, which plays a major role in my current diet. Love the show, and I'm looking forward to the book.
Yeah, ELISA testing is legit, and this is where we see some things like eggs. We've kind of understood from some previous podcasts, from some work that Professor Cordain has done, they do pose a little bit of a gut irritation potential. That there are some proteins in the eggs, similar to grains and legumes, that can pose some problems to people. So that's not super surprising for, you know, to see some egg allergy. But then you see some wacky things for a lot of people, like chicken and beef and stuff like that. Where those allergies grow from is we're consuming other foods, say like grains, legumes, dairy, that cause the initial damage to the gut lining. And then that allows us to then take in intact food particles of things that we normally wouldn't become allergic to. Beef, chicken, watermelon, you know, different things like that. For a lot of people, if they address the gut damage very, very thoroughly, then things like a beef allergy should kind of go into remission, should decrease. And this is another really strong argument for some rotation in your food supply. So say like you do a week or so of beef, a week or so of lamb, a week or so of chicken, seafood, pork, and then you come back around to beef. And Edo is very big into this. Polikin is very big into this. Czech is pretty big into this. So it makes sense. In implementation, it can be kind of tough to pull off. But if you have a you know, you obviously are positive on the ELISA test for some food allergies. If you want to address this, then a really being pretty fastidious about your rotation of your food would definitely help. So that when that beef does pop back up again, you only have an exposure for a certain period of time, and then you pull it out of rotation.
Yeah, it's very depressing when they tell you you can't eat beef. I love beef, Rob.
Well, the vegetarians do that all the time. So.
good question. Next, yeah. We got a question from Rito, longtime follower, CrossFitter, and caveman. Love your stuff. Pre-ordered the book. Keep up the good work. Wondering if you've seen this study and news article. I'm guessing your main criticism will be the whole protein quality, omega-6, omega-3 ratio, Intuit paradox thing, but still interested in what your thoughts are. Cheers. So Rito provided a link to an abstract and then also a related article from the BBC that basically says eating less meat may be the key to keeping a healthy weight.
Oh, man.
Rob
so
Wolf.
It seems like I may not be able to maintain non-cursing. We may need some bleeps. Heather Dalton may need to cover her kid's ears here in a minute. You know, it seems like, I don't know, once every 6 months, once a year, one of these things pops up. I think it was maybe 16, 18 months ago was like, meat causes cancer. And everybody was all in a fizz about this. And like, Rob, what do you think about this? And it was the same damn deal. It was a bunch of questionnaires. It's a big, big data set, but it's from food questionnaires, which are horrifically inaccurate. And when they, when that previous study was analyzed, they were considering meat, you know, in quotations, meat. If you ate pizza that had sausage on it, then the whole caloric content of that thing was considered meat. And so this stuff is just ridiculous. Like, show me a mechanism on this. What is the mechanism of action that meat makes you fat, that meat causes cancer? You know, whatever the deal is. And so these correlative studies are not worth the paper they're printed on. Like, you literally should line a birdcage with them or wipe your fanny with them. Like, there is no compelling evidence here at all. Like, we need some sort of, if these people feel that there is compelling evidence at the end of this, they must recommend a proposed mechanism of action, period. Like, these correlative studies just spin shit out. Like, all it does is it keeps these researchers fed and watered and tenured so that they can just keep crunching and re-crunching data that really doesn't tell us anything at all. If you don't propose a mechanism, if there's not something testable here that we could take into a clinical setting, there is no value to it at all. And that's just kind of the beginning and the end of the whole thing. Like, this stuff pops up again and again and again. And then when we really, even on the statistical analysis, this is what happened with the previous situation where, you know, theoretically meat was causing cancer. Then some statisticians got in and really started looking at the way that they were cooking the data. And it was fallacious at best, you know, again, stuff like considering pizza as meat just because it had some meat product on it. It's just ridiculous. But, you know, it's newsworthy, and we're just going to continue to see stuff like this. But if there's not a proposed mechanism associated with these things, it's worthless, in my opinion. Absolutely worthless.
So this reminds me of all the recent blogging about, you know, the analysis that was done recently on the China study. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, did you see Eads's post yesterday, the China study versus China study?
I just glanced at it. Like, I really didn't get a chance to read his analysis on it.
So I'm going to throw a link to that in the show notes, because I think he's talking a lot about, you know, correlation and stuff, and I think it's just mm-hmm. good for people to know. He wasn't really necessarily commenting on all the other stuff that some of the other people had already highlighted, but he was actually going back to the original work that Colin did that was like 2,000 pages or whatever, the diet, lifestyle, and mortality in China, a study of the characteristics of 65 Chinese counties. So we'll throw that in the show notes, because I think he's pointing out some of the same things that you're kind of talking about, so I think it's good for folks just to read that.
Cool. You know, in talking yesterday with Matt Lalonde, it was pretty interesting. He mentioned that a Merck subsidiary in, I believe, Montreal is closing down. And his comment was that even Big Pharma has kind of screwed the pooch on these epidemiological correlative studies. Like, when we start trying to address things like blood lipid problems or perceived blood lipid problems and whatnot, and we're going off of epidemiological studies and then drawing spurious conclusions from these studies, things like statins and the various interventions that are being used trying to deal with metabolic derangement and hyper lipid derangement, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work on a dietary recommendation where we're still recommending kind of a high carb, low fat kind of approach. And it doesn't work on the pharmaceutical intervention side of it either. And so the commentary that correlation is not causation is absolutely true. We need to be, you know, I need to be reminded of that all the time. It can shine a light on an interesting direction that we need to go investigate, but then we need clinical trials, some sort of a verifiable methodology for establishing a mechanism. If you don't have a proposed mechanism of action that can be tested, then this information is largely worthless.
Yep.
So
you didn't swear.
Although I think I said shite once. But,
I don't think that counts.
Okay.
On our low-level requirements for internet radio or whatever, I don't think that counts as swearing.
Perfect. Okay. Perfect.
But good question. Thank you.
Yeah, totally.
I'm really excited about the next one, Rob, because this is just...
Dude, you're just poking the bear today, man.
Hey, man, I'm just trying to clean up some questions, and you're in the echo chamber, Rob Wolf playing God today, so I feel like it's good to get some of these questions out in the open now that you're slowly recovering from the jungle that is West Virginia. No offense to the West Virginians listening. Next, we got a question from...
I'm sure there are no West Virginians listening.
Rob Wolf, someone just emailed me and said they were the 10,000th listener, so that's going to go into the questions at some point.
Awesome.
Next, we got a question from Ahmed. It says, Rob, from reading about the... how do you say that? Jujube? That's what
Jujube?
I was... Fruit. Or wonderful candy, if you're eating sugar. It seems to be a pretty amazing fruit, and it's very low in sugar. It seems to be the definition of the superfruit. This description is ridiculous. Jujube fruit contains some invaluable minerals and vitamins. Amount of vitamin C, which is present in the jujube fruit, is 20 times higher than any other citrus fruit. Along with vitamin C, it also contains many important vitamins from vitamin B complex family like B1, B2, and B6. Benefits are more significant because of the presence of the important minerals in the fruit. These minerals include manganese, potassium, iron, calcium, and phosphorus. Along with the above-mentioned nutrition, jujube fruits are loaded with 18 out of the 24 important amino acids. It is used in the Far East and Middle East as medicine and food. Is it just that we haven't caught on yet in the States? Is it really all that great? Also, will you review this Bozzy drink, which is the only other way to get the jujube fruit other than the fruit itself, to see if it's worth all the money they're charging for it? Really curious to know if the benefits are as amazing as they seem. Oh, the fruit itself is relatively tasteless, but it's definitely not bad. If you have not had any, let me know, and I'll send you some. Thank you.
Yeah, I've had this stuff before, and, you know, like the question of... What was one of the questions? You know, is it worth it and all that sort of stuff? You know, in the States or even, you know, most kind of westernized locations, there is this, I could change the title from this jujube fruit to this other miracle fruit that has 20 times more vitamin C than citrus and has B vitamins and all this great stuff. And it's called blueberries. And like, if you run these things side by side, like, I'm not sure about the amino acid profile of blueberries, but I'm not going to fruits for amino acids. I get that from meat and seafood and eggs. So that part is just wholly unimpressive to me. Everybody's always trying to spin some supplement scene around. And I mean, this is somewhat true of this jujube stuff. You know, compared to other berries, I just shrug. You know, it's like blackberries, blueberries, boysenberries, lingonberries. They're all really, really nutritious, like remarkably nutritious. They kind of kick the pants off of most other fruits, which is why, you know, like if you reread Protein Power Life Plan and even in the paleo diet, you know, the if you're going to choose fruit as a carbohydrate source, usually berries and then melons are kind of your go-to items. And there are some other things like kiwis that are pretty nutrient dense and whatnot. But this is just like marketing hyperbole. If you can get your hands on a bunch of this stuff and roll it into your program, would it be nutritious? Sure, yeah, it would. But it's not like orders of magnitude better than much of anything else out there. And when we look at the nutrient claims, you know, B vitamins, okay, you get tons of that out of meat and veggies. Vitamin C, veggies and fruit in general, you know. And if we, maybe when we're done, I'll try to do a side-by-side comparison of blueberries, blackberries, and the jujube berries and see where the amino acid profile plays out and vitamin C and all that stuff. But I'm just not impressed. And then when we start talking about like juicing this stuff, sticking it in a jar and then using that as some sort of a supplement, it's just goofy. As soon as you juice this stuff, then the nutrient content starts going down. Unless you put some sort of, not even super gnarly stabilizer, but you're going to need some sort of like potassium benzoate or ascorbic acid or something to stabilize the nutrients. Otherwise, the vitamin C is going to be gone anyway. So when you start looking at a juiced variety of this stuff, it's just goofy. If you want to eat it, but there's no magic to this stuff at all. Until I own a jujube farm, in which case there will be massive magic in this stuff, and it'll be jujube morning, noon, and night. So
now, Rob, before you comment on the Bazi drink, please note that its ORAC value is over 2,000 per 2 ounce serving. Okay, so you just need to be aware of that.
That's very impressive.
And it also has all 8 superfruits: jujube, blueberry, goji, mangosteen, raspberry, pomegranate, acai, and sea buckthorn, which is also huge.
What do they have for the stabilizer in that? Like, is there sodium benzoate or something? Or
that's a good question. I was too busy reading about.
I was fishing around on there too, but.
All right. Well, maybe you can just talk about some drinks in general. I'll find it right now. I'm sorry. Bobby Lashley is scaring me because he's flexing.
You know, it's just this stuff is, again, as soon as it's processed, like the nutrient content starts going down. And then we've got the whole glycemic load issue and all that sort of stuff. Like, if you're just really pining for some sort of a juice drink, I guess it's probably okay. But, you know, I don't know. I'm just wholly unimpressed with stuff like this. But again, like I don't own a jujube farm, so I have little financial incentive to spin a bunch of hyperbole on it and try to sell it to people. So.
Yeah, and I think the thing for me is that I guess it's possible. There could be some type of benefit associated with this, maybe, but it's definitely never worth what they're charging for it.
Yeah.
And you know, even if there is.
And you start looking at ORAC and stuff like that, it's like, have some green tea, have some espresso, you know, and you want B vitamins, eat some meat and veggies. You want vitamin C, have some blueberries. You know, the jujube consortium will probably come and shoot me, but yeah, you know, I just... totally unimpressed. If you want to play around with it, go for it. But it is not, it's no more miraculous than anything that most of us, like when we were just in West Virginia, there were blueberries growing all over the place there. All over Northern California, there's blackberries and blueberries and raspberries. You know, most people, most locales have this stuff at varying points in the year within walking distance of their home, you know, unless you live in an urban area. So, and then in that case, you just roll into a Whole Foods or a Trader Joe's or something like that and get some that's reasonably fresh. So, yeah, I'm just not impressed with that stuff at all.
Yeah, and I do not know why I cannot find the rest of the ingredients, so we're sorry. Mm-hmm. And we don't mean to sound rude on this question, but these are like the questions you get every day at the gym.
Yes, yes.
All right, moving on. Question from Steve. Hey, Rob, love the show. Quick question. I try and eat as paleo as possible, however, like most, I have the occasional or more than occasional slip, 90% paleo. I have had allergy tests done, and according to them, I'm not allergic to any foods, including wheat or nuts. I seem to have no medical issues, i.e. cholesterol numbers and triglycerides are all good. I have no ailments. I am lean and perform well. I would be considered a very healthy person. However, I do have a fair amount of stress. I am concerned about long-term health, and if I have no allergy to any food, how dangerous can those cheat days be? Will wheat or gluten or peanut butter have the potential to cause damage down the road? Is there a possibility of a silent autoimmune condition that could rear its ugly head down the road? I know it's impossible to predict what, if any, ailments will come up, but didn't know if you had seen any research or have thoughts on this. Thanks.
Gosh, I mean, this is just standard kind of risk analysis. You know, I think most folks that are in this kind of paleo primal kind of scene, they recognize that certain foods have higher potentiality for problems than others. I would throw wheat, probably, you know, gluten-containing items, absolutely at the top of the hill on that. Probably second to that would be some sort of high omega-6 containing fat sources, you know, like corn oil and soybean oil and all that sort of jive, fructose, high fructose items, just whatever that plays out to be, whether we're talking like a refined product or fruit itself. These are the things that over the course of time are going to potentially cause some problems. And again, talking with Matt LaLonde, email with him, he had a great commentary, which was, if you want to do some, and this was actually in reference to a friend of ours whose father is very, very ill, eats very poorly, has some cardiovascular problems that are probably going to shorten his life significantly. It's a sad situation. And Matt just made the comment that, you know, if you could get the guy doing no omega-6 fats, you know, no corn oil, soybean oil, all that sort of stuff, really limited his nut and seed intake, pull all the gluten out of rotation, and then really limit his fructose dramatically, which would leave you, say, like the guy is still eating rice, he's still eating corn, he's still eating some beans, but we've pulled the sugar, we've pulled trans fats and high omega-6 fats, we've pulled the gluten, person's probably going to be much healthier and do much, much better and probably decrease the likelihood of some sort of problem down the road. Now, do these other foods still pose potential problems? Absolutely, they do. But I think in a risk management scenario that it dramatically mitigates those risks. So, you know, there's no way to put an exact number on any of this stuff. Nobody's done the analysis on this. There's too many moving parts. But I think that order of operations, like gluten, omega-6 fats, trans fats, fructose, like those are the things that if you more often than not keep out of the rotation, I think you're going to do just fine. And then if life ever gets more stressful, if something happens that you really start being assailed from outside, then it would probably behoove you to tighten up your game even more. You know, you start caring for a sick parent or something like that. Like, those are the most challenging times to stay on the rails or to tighten up your food. But that's also probably the time when you need the most support and the most everything going in as favorable direction as you possibly can.
Yep. All right. Good question. Moving on, Rob. We're catching up on time. I like
cool.
It. We're making progress.
I'm trying to shorten my answers. So.
Follow-up from Chris. Rob, I have a client just started our 4-week boot camp program, late 20s, not in shape, 30 to 40 pounds overweight, but no other health issues that I know of. Non-smoker, doesn't drink regularly, no meds. She suffers from insomnia, and I'm wondering if there's anything outside of the traditional paleo diet that you can recommend for her. The first thing that popped in my head was perhaps supplementing with some melatonin, but I hardly feel qualified to be doling out advice on a condition like that. What do you think? Thanks.
Well, the fact that she's 30 to 40 pounds overweight, like, that's just a huge problem right there with regards to insomnia. Like, that hyperinsulinism, the insulin resistance, I will guarantee you this is a contributing and or causative factor in her insomnia. And the bugger is that this becomes the symptom and the cause start becoming one. It becomes kind of a Zen-like observer and the observed kind of thing all become one. The fact that she's overweight disturbs her sleep. When her sleep becomes disturbed, then she becomes more insulin resistant and it's easier for her to get overweight. So she needs to tackle this at probably like low-carb paleo, fish oil, magnesium. The melatonin might be helpful, but you know, the fundamental thing is she needs to get leaned out. She needs to control her sleep hygiene as tightly as she can. Go to bed early, no lights, a quiet, serene kind of environment. Like that's the stuff that she's gotta put together to make all this stuff work. Simply trying to throw a sleep aid into the mix is not the first direction here. Like when you've got some overt pathology, 30 to 40 pounds overweight, then you've got to address that. And I will guarantee you that will deal with the insomnia. But it's tough because it becomes very much a chicken and egg kind of scenario.
I think our approach is generally to clean up everything else first before you would even consider something like melatonin down the road.
Yeah, totally. And we just know that this other stuff works. Katie Stuber is a great example with this insomnia kind of gig. Like, she had pretty significant, well, really severe insomnia ever since she was like 13. And then gluten-free, dairy-free, paleo, leaned out a bunch, and for the first time in her life, now at age like 28 or 30 or whatever, sleeps really well through the night.
Yep.
And I just had dozens and dozens of examples of this.
Yep. All right, good. Good question.
Yeah.
Next, we got a question from Eric. I went to the Red Cross to donate blood yesterday and was almost denied. My iron count was at the low end of the scale. Mine was 12.6 and needed to be at least 12.5 to donate. I think I have those numbers correct. My stats, 46-year-old male, 175 pounds, CrossFit 4 to 5 times a week with strength bias and mainly 15-minute or less Metcons, paleo strict since June 1st, 3 or so cheat meals in that time, and all were a big mistake. Lots of red meat, pork, and chicken, still working in grass-fed. Not a ton of fish in my meals, but I take 2K fish oil supplement each day, sometimes more. Nuts consist of cashews, almonds, not every day. Veggies revolve around carrots, broccoli, cauliflower, peppers, tomatoes, onions, asparagus. Not good with veggie cooking and variety, but working on it. Lots of coconut. I drink a large can of coconut water every 2 days. Sister had low iron also. Mom was kind of low, but not an issue, and Dad was fine. Is there a genetic component to iron? Should I be overly concerned? And if so, suggestions for fixing this? Listen to all your... listen to all your older podcasts. Don't remember this being addressed. Tried to look back at the older podcast, but didn't find it. Thanks for all your help and advice. I listen to your podcast every week as I mow the lawn, have a large lawn, and can get in one full podcast plus some of a second. No rider mower for me. I walk.
Nice.
Which is opposite of my dad, who, as he got a little bit older, even though the lawn was not getting any bigger, he kept getting a bigger and bigger riding mower so that he could do it in less and less time.
That's it. Eventually a nitro-charged lawnmower.
Exactly.
Can drag race it. You know, any of these deficiency scenarios, you know, like osteoporosis, zinc, magnesium, iron deficiencies, certainly there can be, with regards to osteoporosis, a hyperinsulinism piece to us, to the whole scene. But also when we're thinking about absorption, you know, we just have to look at gut health and potential anti-nutrients that are in the mix with our food. And it's frustrating for folks, but if you have a malabsorption issue, let's assume that this is probably what the case is here with this iron deficiency, you don't need all that frequent of a gluten exposure, for example, to cause enough damage to the gut lining to impair iron absorption. And so this may be something where you need to be really, really fastidious, particularly on the gluten side. But I would tackle this gluten, you know, all grains, all legumes, all dairy. I would give this a very thorough shot for about 2 to 3 months and see if that improves your iron absorption. In conjunction with this, if you want to supplement 200 milligrams or so of vitamin C with iron-rich meals, which would be like red meat, some green vegetables, you know, like spinach would be appropriate also, but vitamin C potentiates the absorption of iron. And so this could be a two-pronged approach, you know, 100% paleo, very, very fastidious. Supplement a little bit of vitamin C with your iron-containing meals, and you should see some improvement in this. If you don't, then we might have some sort of a other genetic component that you know that might require some much more aggressive intervention. But that's the stuff that I would do first. That's all I want to say on that. If I crack open what I was just thinking, it's going to be a 10-minute digression, so I'll leave it at that.
Rob Wolf.
Dude.
Next, we got a comment from Justin. Hello, Rob. So I put it on mute to have a drink of my coffee, and I started reading the question. Then I'm like, dude, why is Rob Wolf not answering the question? Because I'm an idiot and left it on mute. This is what happens when we go like 2 weeks without recording. I'm totally screwed right now.
Performance art, folks.
So next we got a question from Justin. Hello, Rob. I'm a recent college graduate preparing for the Police Academy. I'm still living at home, so nutrition is not always awesome. I try to eat as paleo as possible, but generally grass-fed and organic don't happen, and until I get picked up for the academy, costs are a concern. In the future, I plan on being fairly strict paleo, but right now it's tough. So this brings me to my question. Should I take ZMA? I am probably not receiving the zinc and magnesium levels I should and thought it would be a good idea. However, I wanted to ask you if it'd be worthwhile. Thanks.
I think ZMA is kind of one of those things that benefits most people. You can be deficient in it. It's inexpensive. I would give it a shot. And also, you know, the whole organic grass-fed, like, that's nice, but it's by no means a must-do kind of scenario. And the conventional meat, chicken, fish, all that sort of jive, plus whatever fruits and veggies you can get, nuts and seeds, olive oil, I think that can all be done on the cheap, and it's still far better than including any amount of grains and legumes. So I think you can do this inexpensively, but within the parameters of what your situation are giving you.
What about potentially using the money that he would spend on ZMA for some grass-fed meat? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, unless you're buying bulk, you know, the grass-fed meat definitely is pricey. Like, I would just focus more, say, like, if there's a little bit of a shortcoming in general, say, like, he's been doing more, like, brown rice or something like that because of kind of a shortcoming overall in food, say, like, mom is buying some different stuff. I would throw that money more into just fruits, vegetables, eggs, cheap cuts of meat. I would focus on that really before supplementation, mm-hmm. with like ZMA personally.
All right, good.
And then cut out the Neolithic foods. It's that shotgun art of thing, you know. It addresses so many different things so well, and even if it's somewhat suboptimal, you know, it's not grass fed, it's not organic vegetables and all that. Like, that stuff is great. That's nice. Hopefully it becomes more accessible and less expensive as time goes on, but it should not be a deal breaker right now. I would focus the bulk of your efforts into making it as close to like paleo as you can, even within the constraints of like it's got to be conventionally grown stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Question from Matthew. Hi, Rob and Andy. Thanks for the awesome podcast. This resource, more than any other, is what turned me on to paleo. Since starting the diet 4 months ago, I've never felt better. Keep up the good work. My question is on... Man, we got a low bar, apparently.
Yeah, seriously.
My question is on a part of recovery that I don't think has been covered in any of the podcasts. You're often asked about what is the best post-workout nutrition, and I don't think anyone has asked about post-operation nutrition. Just wondering if there are specific foods that are better to eat after having minor to major surgery, and or even if just recovering from an injury on your own, if it limits your ability to exercise. I believe that some people have reported increased recovery while in a state of ketosis, so should someone recovering from injury operation try to lower their carb load enough to induce this state, or would the adaptation cause undue stress on the body if one weren't already in ketosis? I know that most people after an operation just want to eat a bucket of ice cream, but I'm not so sure that is the best method here. Also, when should one stop taking fish oil if you are going to have surgery because of its blood-thinning properties, and when would it be a good time to start up again? Any ideas on how to adjust diet during this period would be greatly appreciated.
You know, before I answer this directly, I just want to throw out there that if we have a large female readership who is interested in post-operative breast augmentation recovery, then Andy and I can certainly offer up our services for counseling that. photo optional, of course. So it is a good question. Polican has some really good protocols with regards to this. It includes some pretty aggressive anti-inflammatories, the use of Wobenzyme, Kirk Heumann, maybe at a future point, maybe we could try to get him on the podcast at some point. We could talk about this because he has a really slick protocol for this stuff. But generally when you have surgery, your activity level is going to decrease. So if the activity level decreases, your need for carbohydrate decreases. So that's smart in that regard to kind of curtail carbohydrate intake. Then from there, just generally being as healthy as you can, which kind of low carb paleo is kind of where that's at, is definitely the way to go. The more healthy you are, the quicker you're going to heal. And obviously there's certain limitations to that, but it's all other things being even, if you're healthier, you tend to heal more quickly. The fish oil thing, the most important thing to do with that is just simply talk to your doctor. Certain doctors, certain operations, they don't care if you're taking fish oil. Other doctors, other situations, they want you to stop the fish oil. So, and that's preoperative. Typically postoperative, just ask your doc, hey, is it okay if I reintroduce the fish oil, the day after, 2 days after? Typically that's fine, but just bounce it off your doc. It really depends on the situation, how extensive the surgery is, what your particular scenario is, and all that sort of stuff. So just communicate with your doc, and usually they can give you some good feedback on that. But generally, just eat well, low-carb paleo, communicate with your doc about fish oil supplementation, both pre and post, and you should recover as well as you possibly can. And then within your ability to do so, get active as quickly as you can. I know, like Eileen, who I have a pretty good interaction with her on Facebook. She just had some knee surgery. And she was working out all the time, but working her upper body, working the good leg and all that. And she had really, really good recovery from, I believe, an ACL repair. And we just see that all the time. Like, if folks stick to their food, don't turn into the, cookies and ice cream monster and just sit on the couch, you recover much faster. And then once you're fully recovered, then have a weekend of cookies and ice cream and like reward yourself for it. But don't do it while your recovery is in its really critical stage.
Yep. All right, good. And last question of the episode, Rob.
Woohoo! Ding, 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 ding.
Question from Flavio. Hey, Rob, quick question. I know coconut milk is an awesome fat source, but usually one of the ingredients is xanthan gum. I read on Wikipedia that residual wheat gluten has been detected on xanthan gum made using wheat. Should I avoid consuming coconut milk that contains this ingredient? What is your take on this? Thank you.
This was news to me, and this is actually pretty interesting. It makes a really strong argument for finding a coconut milk or a coconut cream that does not contain xanthan gum, and or checking with the manufacturer to see what their xanthan gum source is. The modified food starch is another one of these items that can be gluten contaminated or can be gluten derived. So this was a new one to me, and it's a good point. It's a good point, and definitely something to be considered.
Nice. All right, Rob, that's the end of episode 39. Any final thoughts?
I have no thoughts.
Well, we already know. Well, even with rambling for 15 minutes, we're coming in just shy of an hour.
Nice. Well, heading out to Arlington this weekend, which I don't think this will post, I guess, the weekend after. I've had that, but doing a Paleolithic Solution gig in Arlington, and then we have one coming up in Oakland and Monrovia, Denmark, and then we're putting some on the books for UK, Australia, New Zealand, and in the United States. And we're going to try to dovetail that stuff with some book signing type thing. So we're just trying to figure out all the logistics of the book signing, and then also doing some Paleo Solution seminars. So I'll be out and about spreading the pseudoscientific gospel that is the Paleolithic Solution.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, Rob, and with that, that is the end of episode 39. Thank you for your time, and we'll talk to you next week.
Awesome. Thanks, Andy.
All right, see you, Rob.
Bye.